On Piled High and Deep, the podcast today, we're shoveling with another doctorate in chemistry. And instead of food, we're talking about forensic science. But it's not that icky CSI kind of forensic science, you know, with dead bodies. Today, our journey leads us into the study of cause and effect, the causes and origins of fires, mechanical failures, and other unexpected incidents. Now, it's not necessarily what our guest had in mind when he went to college, let alone the beginning of his PhD. But as we all know, change is a constant in our lives. And as a result of change, he was able to develop skills beyond his research, serving him today as he takes a look to solve the mysteries of when bad things happen to good people.
There was an element of the unknown that came through that floundering period, that transition period, those early years with Mike, where I really had to get creative in my thinking. I read a lot of fundamental research papers to try and inspire that. And in the forensic engineering world, there's so many different ways that things can go wrong. Any investigation can be completely different than anything you've ever investigated before.
From the swamps of Florida to the brew pubs of Fort Collins, Colorado, today we have a doctoral journey that shows you're not limited to the research that brought about your PhD. Instead, it's the skills that you learned in the process that can help drive your work after you're done piling it high and deep. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by Mountain Geek Productions. That's me, Ted Conti. Check out my blog at themountaingeek.net. Also have a Twitter account for the podcast, PhD Podcast. Also my own Twitter musings at Mountain Geek. And on Facebook, we're there also, Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Well, that's enough self-promotion on social media. Let's start shoveling. Sean Sapp, thank you very much for joining the podcast today. We are in the offices of Advanced Engineering Investigations in Littleton, Colorado. Sean Sapp is their lead scientist. He has a PhD. We're going to get to that. Sean, thank you very much for piling it high and deep today.
Thanks for having me, Ted. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
What drove you to get your PhD?
Well, as an undergraduate, I actually started out as an engineering student and kind of hit a wall a little bit of the way into that. It wasn't quite what I was expecting. I went into environmental engineering, and that sounded kind of idealistic and nebulous and cool at the time. But it turned out that was more about managing solid waste, dealing with air pollution, or dealing with wastewater. And those things didn't have as much appeal for me once I sort of dug into them a little bit. That led me to the physical sciences as you know, I was naturally kind of an analytically minded person. So when I decided to switch majors, chemistry really clicked for me. It had always been sort of I had a natural proclivity for it. I was always helping the students around me solve their homework problems and work through different, you know, issues of classes together. So that's where I headed, sort of blindly, I might say. And then as I approached my senior year of graduation from undergraduate, I realized that I didn't really have any experience that set me apart. I had just taken the classes towards the degree. And so I started asking some of my other classmates what they were doing for experience outside of the classroom. And I discovered, to my shock, that a lot of undergraduate students were working with professors at the university and doing independent research with their grad students as a part of their research group. And so I started asking around some of my professors, and I finally got a little bit of interest back from my organic chemistry professor, John Reynolds. He was at the University of Florida in Gainesville at the time, and now he's at Georgia Tech, I believe, is where he's at. But it basically, what led to me going to grad school directly was that moment of interviewing with Professor John Reynolds, my organic chemistry professor, and saying, look, I don't want to just take classes. I want to do something more. I'd be interested in working on research. And he, after sort of screening me for, you know, a couple of preliminary interviews, he decided to offer me a position in his group and basically doing independent research alongside his grad students, learning how research work happens in reality, rather than just learning things out of a textbook and on the chalkboard. So the unwritten agreement that I had with him was that he would take me under his wing, he would give me this opportunity, and if all went well, I would apply to grad schools. And he really didn't want me to go into medical school or vet school. He had had a couple of undergraduate apprentices that had gone that route, and he really wanted somebody that was going to be dedicated to the physical sciences. And at the time, I didn't really have a good concept or game plan for what my future held. So I was excited to dig in to the research, and I wanted that opportunity greatly. It was the best thing that I had heard of in a long time as far as careers. So I agreed that I would apply to grad school, and if I got accepted, I would go to, you know,
wherever it led. It took you. Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about, and we'll get into the specifics of what you did. What do you do now?
What I do now, I'm like you said, I am the lead scientist here at AEI. I'm specifically a material scientist, and the work that our company does is we are engineering consultants. We call ourselves a forensic engineering firm. What that means is that when what most people would call an accident, and not talking about vehicle accidents so much, but say explosions or fires, floods, when those occur in either homes or commercial buildings, there's a lot that happens behind the scene to try and find out what actually occurred that caused the flood or the fire or the explosion, especially if someone is injured or killed in an accident. You know, people really want to know what happened. And so we come in as independent engineering and scientific experts to look at the evidence in any given incident. Now, we call them incidents because accident is sort of a loaded word in the legal world. But we investigate these variety of incidents to try and find out what the origin and cause of those incidents were and who might be implicated as far as liability or fault. We're often hired by attorneys. We're often hired by manufacturers or the insurance companies for, say, homeowners or tenants. So we work all over the country. And again, we do a variety of things. So as a material scientist, where I fit in is I am often looking at the fundamental failures. I'm looking at fractures. I'm looking at cracks, broken pipes, rust. Now, that may seem odd for a chemist to be looking at materials, but I consider myself a material scientist as well as a chemist. So I've worn many hats throughout my career. I started out in research and development, working on a lot of different government projects, getting funding from federal agencies. And so it turned out that developing materials from scratch or from just an initial concept, taking them through to actually having them work in some kind of device, that lent itself very well to the kind of work I now do, where I look at failures and I look at the chemistry of the surfaces of broken materials. And I see what that tells me about how that break occurred or how that failure occurred.
When you were leaving your undergrad, going to grad school, ultimately to your PhD, is this what you saw yourself doing?
I don't think so at all. In the undergraduate, well, prior to me getting on board with research and development, I had just envisioned being a bench chemist, which means you're just running a lot of samples through an analytical method most of the time. And I hadn't really, you know, either that or I might have gone into, there was an Energizer plant in Gainesville. And I had thought, well, maybe, you know, they hire chemists out of University of Florida, so maybe I'll go work with them. Join the bunnies, make batteries, and, you know, figure out the chemistry side of that. But no, because of my ability to work in a lab and sort of connect the dots as you're investigating just any line of questioning in chemistry or material science, I I was very good at envisioning what were the analytical techniques, what kind of microscope did I need to use? What kind of chemical analysis did I need to use to answer the questions of fundamental research? It turns out those are the same questions that are often asked after an incident like an explosion or a fire occurs, is how did this happen? What are the techniques that we can use to look at the evidence that we have left after the fact to tell us, to guide us into more information, more knowledge, and answers as to how something happened. So I thought I would go into R&D as I approached grad school. And it was clear that I had a knack for working in the lab. I was a very hands-on, very dexterous kind of person. There's an art behind science that a lot of people might not appreciate, and a lot of that has to do with intuition at the bench, intuition in the lab, in order to connect the dots. You know, you only have so many facts that you're working with or knowns that you have, you know, in your arsenal, and you've got to be able to sort of take the leap intuitively to through an unknown area to try and answer more questions, to try and fill in the gaps between the factual dots.
What makes you different at this level, let's say in the forensic sciences? As a PhD, what do you have that maybe somebody that only has a master's or just that undergrad? What value does the PhD bring to you here?
I think there's a level of exposure that the years that you spend in graduate school doing, let me back up. The years of grad school, let me focus in on that. The reason
And we're going to talk more about it later as well.
The reason it can take years to finish a physical sciences dissertation, in my case, just short of 6 years, a lot of that is because any one project or any one creative idea that you start out working on, a line of investigation that you start out with, a lot of those don't pan out. So they're dead ends, or your hypotheses are not what you expect, you know, don't turn out
right
the way you thought they would. And so you often have to change directions. And what that means is that you have to wear many hats in terms of your background knowledge. And you find yourself reaching for the bookshelf, going to the library, pulling papers from the 1960s, pulling papers from yesterday, going to conferences and listening to what all the cutting edge work that's being done, you know, right now is, and then synthesizing that in your mind to come up with, okay, here's an area that's ripe for investigation, and then you have to sell that to both your advisor and your committee and your fellow grad students who you work with every day. So there's a PhD brings a wealth of exposure of many different areas and fields. I mean, I had to get more knowledgeable about physics, when I started grad school, I didn't think I would ever be working with lasers. That was the realm of physical chemists or other, you know, engineers and physicists would often deal with fundamental laser research. And I ended up working with a very interesting and custom laser system in the end to do some chemical analysis. And that was not something I expected, but I carry that knowledge with me to this day, that experience that came from being exposed to cutting-edge laser technologies. Dabbling in collaborations with people, other grad students, other professors in the chemistry, physics department, or the College of Engineering. So I guess to circle back to the original question, it's sort of when you spend many years working on your dissertation, you invariably take a meandering path, and that meandering path is very valuable when you have things as different that I deal with in the forensic sciences, something from a buried underground gas line that might have a specific kind of corrosion working on it that caused it to rupture or leak, to having an exploding asphalt tank up in Wyoming where they mix asphalt for the paving season, to someone who's gotten chemically burned and there's no real obvious reason why they got a chemical burn in the environment that they did. So you often have to rely on a very diverse background in order to answer those questions that we're faced with. Coming at, you know, in the forensic sciences world, there's a lot of different failures that come at us fast and furious. And to try and apply science and engineering to those, it really helps to have a lot of experience.
What kind of a kid were you growing up? Were you a pretty inquisitive kid? Were you looking under rocks? Were you asking a lot of questions?
I was very inquisitive. You know, I grew up in the swamps of Florida, is the way I call it. This was not, I mean, in some ways, I straddled the line between Disney and the swamps, which were kind of polar opposites of each other.
Right.
Completely artificial world and a completely natural and sort of aggressive world. But my father worked at Disney for about 23 years, from before I was born and until later in life as an adult. And that part of growing up in Florida did not appeal to me, but trudging around in the woods, looking under rocks, as you say, snorkeling in the freshwater springs, going canoeing. I was very inquisitive. I was very nature-oriented. I was very outdoorsy. But I was also very nerdy. You know, the kind of my favorite toys growing up, I give a lot of credit to Legos.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I was playing with Legos throughout my entire childhood. So there was always a building, tinkering. I was always taking things apart, trying to put them back together. And I also have to credit my parents and my relatives. My father's side of the family particularly, they were, my father and his brothers were jacks of all trades. And so they were always working on cars. We were always building additions to the local family's houses, adding a hot tub. We did everything ourselves because we couldn't afford really to hire a contractor. So we just helped each other out. So I learned all kinds of things from plumbing, wiring, construction, and then the natural curiosity in the outdoor world, I think, fits with the physical sciences quite well.
What did your dad do at Disney?
He started out working as a grease monkey, a mechanic in the monorail shop. And monorails were a new technology at the time. They were basically taking train engines, tractor engines, diesel generators, things like that to propel these vehicles that were unique and no one had really done much work with that. And so he was in charge of keeping those things up and running, which was quite a tough task in the beginning. After that, after the monorail shop, was right about that same time was when computers entered the workplace in a major way. And he had a natural knack for picking up the computer as a useful tool. And that was also a time when pensions at a company existed and longevity and, you know,
right.
You know, company sort of, unfortunately, it seems like that's all archaic now to talk about a pension
with
a
absolutely.
Company. But he was able to move up in Disney as a corporation, as an entity. And he eventually did what's called preventive maintenance. So he basically was in charge of the computer system that dictated maintenance scheduling and preventive maintenance scheduling for the rides, the boats, you know, anything that needed maintenance and tended to break down was included in this system. So he was one of many superintendents that was in charge of that computer system.
Did either of your parents go to college?
My father went briefly, and I think he maybe only got through about a year and a half in undergraduate, and I think he tried to get his business administration undergraduate degree, and he ended up going back, and he didn't finish it until I think the late 80s, mid or late 80s. But and then he eventually got an MBA as well. My mother went to a vocational college in Tennessee where she learned. She initially started out, she thought she wanted to be a nurse, and then ended up going for a teaching degree. And so, not highly educated. I believe I am the first PhD on either my mother or father's side of the family.
Was college kind of expected for you?
It did seem to be expected. And in high school, in junior high and high school, when other students were either kind of deciding whether they are physically capable of going into competitive athletics versus sticking to the academics or, you know, going the artistic route or being really involved in music. That was a time when my academics really shone through. And so it was sort of just a natural drifting that I had towards, you know, I was a geek. I was a nerd, you know, and I was good at school. I was good at test taking. So, yes, it felt like a foregone conclusion that I would go to college.
What was your favorite RPG when you were a kid? Were you a D&D kid?
You know, that... I did Battletech was the right. only role-playing, like dice okay. rolling.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about dice rolling games. Battletech was more my forte. I didn't get into Dungeons & Dragons too much. And then later, as computer gaming came online, Doom, the first ever Doom, which was just
unbelievable.
So pixelated and you know, embarrassing, but it was incredible. It was incredible at the time. For a kid who grew up with a monochrome monitor, DOS, and, you know, floppy disks of various sizes
right.
and enormity, Doom was sort of the first real,
right.
you know, amazing moment in computer gaming. And that's first-person shooter
right,
rather
yeah.
than role-playing. I didn't do the RPG too much.
Okay. So... You're growing up, you're in the swamps of, as you said, you're on the edge between the swamps of Florida and Disney World down there. How did you end up at the University of Florida? Was that just kind of a natural flow out of high school? Did you have some direction from teachers in high school that said maybe you need to go this way?
I was in a public high school in Apopka, Florida, and that's in Orange County. It's just kind of northwest of the greater Orlando metro area. And I have to credit the public school system of Florida at that time. I don't know if it's currently as good as it used to be. But they had an excellent honors program. So I was in a lot of honors classes, my English classes, all my math and physics. And science classes were honors classes. And so that led to smaller size classes with a teacher who was maybe a tier above the other teachers, their other peers. And the writing requirements the state of Florida had at that time were actually quite stringent. I mean, the number of words that one had to write in order to get out of high school with your degree was pretty stringent, especially in the honors program. So right. I had a lot of exposure to writing and a lot of exposure to very good teachers. And when you're an honors student at a high school that's as big as mine was, now, my graduating class in 91 was 450 students. Okay, that's just the graduating seniors. I think it started out around 700-something at the start of senior year. So... And that's not unusual for a lot of public high schools to have a drop-off of students dropping out their senior year. But it was a very large high school. But despite that, by being in the honors program, I had really good hands-on teachers. And it was assumed, given that I was in that sort of higher level of teaching and learning that we would go to college. And so all the teachers were focused on, well, where are you thinking? Are you going to go out state or are you going to stay in state? And the other thing I have to credit the state of Florida with is if you graduate from a public high school at the time I did with a certain GPA or higher, and you had a certain number of advanced placement or honors classes, then you basically got a full ride scholarship as long as you went to a public university within the state. So there was sort of a laundry list of all the usual suspects, Florida State, University of Central Florida, University of Southern Florida, and University of Florida. They were all on the list, as well as many others, I'm sure. But amongst my friends, Florida State and University of Florida were really the only two viable options. They were considered the top tier. So I applied and was accepted into both FSU and University of Florida. And that was at a time, again, where I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do. It turned out I was kind of fortunate that I went towards engineering initially because the better engineering college, at least in my opinion, Florida State alumni might argue with me on this particular note, but, you know, University of Florida to me was the better choice for the engineering. And it turned out that applied as for the physical sciences as well. again.
So did you go in the engineering program? Is that how you went in and then you transferred to arts and sciences then?
Yeah, it turned out through sort of a coincidence of my parents relocating overseas. My father worked on Euro Disneyland, the startup of Euro Disneyland in Paris, and they actually lived in Paris for about a year. That was right at the time when I was going to be starting college, and it was really convenient for me to stay at home, live in the house for free, take care of the house while they were living in Paris. And so I actually went to a community college. Again, it was part of the Florida public college system, so my full ride scholarship still applied. But because it was a local community college, they essentially let me go there for free. And I was able to bank my full ride scholarship monies to use when I got to University of Florida. So the idea was I went to a 2-year community college, I got my Associate of Arts degree, and then I transferred to University of Florida, and then I went straight into the College of Engineering. Gotcha. Because I had already gotten my Associate of Arts degree. Now, if I had known the number of people who fail going down that pathway of going from a community college to a full university 2 years later, I would not have done it that way. I kind of wish I mean, granted, it's hard to second guess the fact that I've gotten where I have, but I think it would, if I'd have known that essentially there's like 90% of community college students who go to large universities tend to bail within a year. So looking back, I'm glad I went the route I did and I ended up where I did, but...
Yeah, but you missed out on all the freshmen and sophomore living in the dorms.
Living in the dorms, that has its own culture.
Yep, it sure does. How did you find... So you go through... And you get your AA. How did you find the next 2 or 3 years of your undergrad? Was it fairly easy for you?
The coursework itself was relatively easy. Again, I've always been a good test taker. I've always been a good absorber. I was always the kind of student who sat in class, and I found that I would retain the lecture information better if I sat and listened and took minimal notes. Now, I would take... When the lecturers, professors would indicate, okay, now this is something that you're going to see again, I would typically write that down and make a note for myself. But unlike a lot of my peers, I found that I absorbed and retained the information better if I just focused on the lectures and class materials. So I think some of my student peers at the time resented that to some degree. I felt that. And I had some good friends as well that we shared with each other how we were feeling and how we were doing in school.
I had a roommate in college, Craig, who I remember getting a call at like 2:30 in the morning from somebody who had found our number, angrily screaming at Craig because he had blown the curve in whatever upper level calc class. Were you that kind of kid?
I don't think I was too much as an undergraduate. I was also exploring freedom and independence at the time. So I fell into a group of friends in Gainesville where we had a healthy mix of playing hard and working hard. We were all eventually that. Now this is after I changed to chemistry. Before that, when I was in the College of Engineering, I hit a wall. I absolutely hit a wall because I thought, well, what did I do to get here? And it just seemed like I hadn't thought this through. And what I was seeing in my classes didn't really match up. So in some ways, I fit in with that 90% that would hit a wall after they moved to a big university from a community college.
Right.
But luckily, friends and family, parents mainly, convinced me. I wanted to bail for a little while before I changed my majors. But friends and family talked me down from the ledge a little bit and had me, look at, well, what are the courses that you've taken so far and what can those be applied to if you were to switch majors?
Right.
And that led me to chemistry.
Was that pretty quick? So that would have been about your junior year. Was that a roadblock you were running into at the junior year or maybe even a little after that?
That was junior year. Probably at the end of the junior year is what I would say was where I was hitting that. And so That set me back a little bit, but the course requirements for chemistry versus environmental engineering were not so different. So it ended up being, it set me back a little bit. I was 5.5 years getting my undergraduate degree.
There's nothing wrong with that. I did the 5.5 year thing. Right. My liver suffered a little bit. I didn't have the same maybe issues that you did. So you finally latch on to that physical science part of it. The undergrad is in chemistry?
The undergrad is in chemistry, yeah, general chemistry.
And walk me through kind of like that last year. What was that independent research project that you did that then led you on to grad school?
Okay. Without getting too the technical side, I mean, the field of specialty that my undergraduate advisor was into was he was an electronic polymers guy. Okay. Now I say the word electronic and polymer. What are those? Think of plastics that can actually respond to electricity. Okay. And these are actually things that are in objects that we walk around with every day. Most of our cell phones have electronic polymers in them to some degree or another. A lot of them for static dissipation, preventing electrical shock from your batteries if something goes wrong. In flat screen displays and big screen TVs, these are often used. And they're kind of a material that spans the gap between the semiconductor world, like microchips and computers, integrated circuits. They span from that side of the world to plastics, what we think of as, you know, plastic containers and films and it's an odd area to be in. But what I ended up working on, to get away from the jargon a little bit, were windows that change color they're battery-driven color-changing windows, okay? Imagine if you could tune your sunglasses to whatever color you wanted.
Right.
Or whatever darkness you wanted. And, you know, the lofty goals were, we could make windows in buildings that you could basically tune either the color or how dark or how clear they were. But mostly what I was doing was making tiny little devices that were no bigger than a postage stamp, maybe a half of a postage stamp in size. And we were looking at how you could switch them from one color to another while still letting light pass through. So these were called electrochromic devices. I found it very exciting,
yeah,
very
absolutely.
New. And it's still an area where the most successful ones that are out there on the market are rear view mirrors. There are these auto-dimming rear-view mirrors.
Yep.
So those are made by a company that they used to be up in Michigan, Gentex, I believe was their name. And we were all looking at what they were doing at the time with prototypes and drooling over it and trying to come up with a different way of doing that. So it was a very applied research. I could sink my teeth in. I could get why it was cool. And suddenly there was a whole other reason to learn something new. It was to try and figure out what next. How can we make these cool devices and make them better? And in order to make them better, I've got to learn a lot. I've got to learn how to deposit the polymers. I've got to learn how to separate the polymers with a gel that keeps them from shorting out each other. They're kind of like batteries that change color, is how I kind of describe them to people.
But so at some point, you are mashing up chemistry, physics, because you need to understand how this substance is interacting on the surface of whatever you're putting it on. And then you also have to have a little electrical engineering in there as well, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it turned out that working on my car, playing with Legos, being a kid looking under rocks and building tree forts, it turned out that all of that played a role in trying to expand that toolbox for research purposes. I mean, I really can't stress enough how much, you know, in the material science world, you're not just a chemist, you're not just an engineer, you're not just a physicist. You need all three of those. And those are the three that I really key in on. I think of chemistry and physics as being related fundamental sciences, and then engineering as the kind of applied world that dances back and forth between physics and chemistry.
Well, I think... I remember hearing someplace, or it was a Neil deGrasse Tyson argument with a chemist, you know, about really where is the basic, you know, where does the basic fundamental building blocks, where does it begin? Is it based in physics or is it based in chemistry? And I think just, you know, sitting here, it's probably about 60-40 physics and chemistry.
I think most people would weigh it heavily on the physics side. Now, I'm biased, and I'll admit that.
Right.
I'll say that up front. But I actually think of most of physics as chemistry writ large. Okay? I mean, the world of quantum mechanics is essentially a physicist's take on chemistry. But it is in and of itself, even though you're dealing with fundamental particles or subatomic particles, that's still chemistry is the way I look at it. So it depends on the way you label things, and the way you think of things. But, I have used physics my whole career. I have used chemistry my whole career, and almost always that has been to an applied goal. And because of that, engineering plays a role.
Right.
Because you can't build real world devices. You can't build prototypes without wearing an engineer's hat.
Absolutely. All right, so you had mentioned before that you get into, you're doing some independent work only because the mentor at that time, the professor that you're working for, says, that's fine, but you got to go do something with it that's not, and I don't want you to go be a doctor.
Right.
So how do you end up then finding what that next step is?
What happened is the work went really well. The research went really well. We ended up making devices that worked well enough that we could show them off and people were paying attention. And I was given the opportunity to present this research at a couple of scientific meetings. American Chemical Society meeting was one of them. And that exposure to what the national stage looks like for chemistry researchers and material sciences researchers was very appealing. It was very alluring to my young undergraduate eyes. And the fact that people were complimenting me on my work was astounding. And we ended up publishing two main papers that I had a hand in writing. I actually was, the grad students that I was working with were very generous in allowing me to draft, you know, original parts of these papers, these research papers, but a lot of them were working very nearly on similar research. So, but they were generous in terms of letting me have a piece of the limelight, if you will, or the spotlight. And that's why I ended up where I did, is, you know, the work was very rewarding. It went well. I was published. Suddenly I had a record that could be looked at by other professors in the scientific literature. And these were peer-reviewed journal articles. These weren't just, you know, trade journals or university publications.
Right.
So that opened my eyes to what I would say the academic R&D world was like, and I wanted more. Okay, and when you added to the mix the notion that I could move to somewhere like Colorado, you know, I miss the swamps to some degree. I miss the ocean. I miss seafood, but I don't miss Florida per se. Okay, I don't miss the humidity. I don't miss getting bitten by everything that flies or crawls around. So I was looking for a change when I finished my undergraduate, and suddenly this opportunity of grad school, the whole nation was a possibility because I could apply to different universities anywhere I wanted to. And when I talked to my advisor about, well, what were the universities that he, you know, where he had connections, okay? Because really, as we all know, it all boils down to who you know.
Who you know.
Who you know.
Absolutely. Yep.
So, and that was true for grad school as well. You know, I didn't have the most stellar GPA coming out of undergraduate because of my stint with hitting the wall in engineering. So it took him, you know, making some phone calls or, you know, greasing the wheel, so to speak, for my acceptance into various graduate schools.
Do you think the research spoke for itself, though?
I think it did. I think in the end, the body of work that I came out of undergraduate with was really what sold them on me. Because when a chemistry department, and I'm speaking for an entity here that's probably a little bit daring of me, but when chemistry departments, they want student candidates who are not just book smart for the most part, they want someone who's also good with their hands and good with people. And I think that the experience and advice I was given by the graduate students that I worked with gave me the right mindset for entering grad school in terms of the kind of people I wanted to surround myself with, the kind of science I wanted to go after, and also the skills that I needed to bring to bear in order to be successful. So
how did you find CSU, though? I mean, you're a Florida kid. It's Colorado State University. It's Fort Collins. You know, it's a great university. It's fabulous. And even though it's well known, if you're a listener to the podcast, I went to the better school down the road up in, down in Boulder, but tremendous university. But it sounds like you had a lot of opportunities to choose. You might have had five or six different options. How did you end up at Fort Collins?
The side of chemistry that I was working in, this electrochemistry and polymers and synthesis of new materials, that was those were strong suits at CSU's chemistry department, whereas at the time at CU Boulder, their strong suits were more in the physical chemistry, and bioanalytical chemistry was big there as well. But they didn't really have I looked at their research, but they really didn't make the first cut for me because I was really looking to continue on in the electronic materials development world, and CSU had more options for me. And also, my undergraduate advisor knew two of the professors at CSU. So, actually, no, that's not true. He had three different professors, and all three of those were potential candidates for me when I just looked at them on paper. What really sold me on CSU was when I went to do a visit. Now, most grad schools, once they accept you as a candidate into their program, I kind of recall that only 20-30% of students who are accepted into a grad school are ever actually, go to that grad school or accept that position. So they have to accept many more. Any given department has to accept many more students than they'll actually get for an incoming year.
Okay.
Now, you're checking out, not only are you checking out the research and the professors and the students, but you're also checking out the environment. If you're an outdoorsy person like I am, you're looking for what are the opportunities for hiking and camping and fishing? What kind of food opportunities are there? Is it a good town to be a foodie? I'm a foodie, and I think a lot of chemists tend towards that side of things just naturally.
Just listen to the second episode or the third episode of Piled High and Deep. Zach Reed, food scientist, undergrad in chemistry.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I think there's a natural connection there. But this was happening in 96 was when I was visiting grad school. That coincided with the early years of New Belgium Brewing Company, Odell Brewing Company. There was a brewing company called H.C. Berger at the time.
Right.
It's now called Fort Collins Brewery in its new incarnation. So not only was the chemistry department a highlight of our visitation to the CSU campus, but we made stops at all of the local breweries. We got tours. We got taken out to very good restaurants where these beers were featured. So it was excitement that was palpable in the air in Fort Collins for anyone who was interested in brewing or good food and just sort of living the high life, if you will.
Did you have others from the University of Florida that came with you?
I didn't, actually.
Okay.
No, I was, as far as I know, there was no one else. Even in other departments, I wasn't aware. I had friends that were engineers or physicists, and no one that I knew of chose CSU.
Okay. All righty. The next step then is you get in. Did you just go straight to the PhD? Did you do an MS beforehand? I get the sense in talking about these types of programs, it seems to me, if you have your eye on a PhD, you're going straight to the PhD. You're not necessarily worrying about the master's. Was that the case for you?
Yes, yeah. In the physical sciences, and I don't know if this is true still or if it's different from university to university, but for the most part, the notion is that if you're going to be accepted into grad school, you are going for a PhD, and you're accepted as a PhD candidate. Most chemistry departments at the time would not accept you if you were declaring that you were a master's student to begin with. Essentially, the pathway to a master's degree, at least at CSU chemistry department, was you entered as a PhD candidate, and about a month before you were due to give your oral examination, about 2 years in, you would declare yourself a master's candidate at that stage.
Gotcha.
So... And I think that has to do with the faculty wanting to get a return on their investment. I mean, this is an indelicate way of talking about it, the relationship between faculty and students. But in a sense, they're a commodity. They are the feet on the ground, the hands in the lab. They're doing the labor. They're doing the physical labor of scientific research. And there's quite an investment on the professor's part. Not just in terms of money, but in terms of time and resources to train them on how to do research. So someone who comes to the show and declares themselves a master's right out of the gate, they're kind of looked at as less desirable by any given advisor, professor who's doing research, because you have to put almost the same amount of time to train up that young student to do research, and then the amount of research they do is very limited for the time frame of a master's degree. So, I mean, I understand it from both sides. Having been a grad student, we understood the game a little bit, and then now looking back, I get it. I understand. It's about time and resources and what you can get done. But the bottom line was I was always going for the PhD.
The PhD, the dissertation title. Go ahead and drink your water here. It takes me a little bit to get through this. How much of it do you can you remember?
Ooh.
All right. So it's materials synthesis strategies for microstructure self-assembly, polymer encapsulated reverse micelles, ionic donors in biomolecular photosystems, and efficient mediators in dye sensitized solar cells. That's a mouthful.
It's very much a mouthful. And I really wish I could have distilled it into something less, but I tried many different approaches to distill that into sort of more global language. Now, material synthesis, there is a colon, I believe. Isn't there after material synthesis?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
Yes.
So the real title I like to say is material synthesis, period.
Right.
And all that comes after that are descriptors of each of my chapters, essentially. And they were so diverse, they were so varied, that material synthesis was the only label that I could kind of put to unify those diverse areas of research.
So let's talk about that research journey that you had, because you had said before, you mentioned it was 6 years. So I'm guessing that 6 years from your first day of class up in Fort Collins until you're walking with your in your robes. So that first 2 years, that's just some general master's under graduate education. You're still taking
coursework. Yeah.
At what point do you identify these five topics that you're going to focus on? Did you come up with them on your own? Were they handed to you? Tell me about that.
Well, none of them were handed to me, and that's part of that meandering pathway that I discussed earlier, that you tried to go you try a variety of ideas, and you see which one there are meat on. And the first blurb after material synthesis there, which is template synthesis?
Strategies for microstructure self-assembly.
Okay, strategies for self-assembly. That was the first very successful research effort that I had. And I started with a professor that I ended up, he ended up moving to the University of Florida in my second year of grad school. And I didn't want to go back with him. I mean, this is kind of an aside here, but it's necessary for my journey in that, you know, I started with a group that my undergraduate advisor, he was one of the three professors that he knew well at CSU. And we were working on making micromaterials and nanomaterials. And these are things that are like tubes and spheres, and they're like fundamental Legos, and essentially that are too small for the world's tiniest pair of tweezers.
Right.
And we were seeing what we could do with them. And so while I was given a basis set for how to make these materials, one of my tasks that the professor did hand to me was, okay, take the next step. Find something cool and useful that we can do with these microstructures, with these nanomaterials. And that was a much bigger challenge than just making microstructures, making nanomaterials. And the word self-assembly in that title is what we discovered we could do with them. We could make things sort of spontaneously link together. And we were trying to link rods and spheres together. And that sounds strange, but it is a tinker toy kind of concept that we were exploring. So the other three chapters came with a second advisor that I picked after my first advisor left. And because of that transition, he was naturally looking at other areas of research. So suddenly I had to shift from the basic research world, this niche area of microstructures and nanostructures. I had to switch from that over to things like solar cell materials. And
makes sense. Colorado is the sunniest place, you know, at least in the United States.
Right. Yeah. No, there was a lot of solar cell research going on in the chemistry department at the time. And we also have the National Renewable Energy Labs right here. So that also sort of cements alternative energy technologies here on the Front Range.
Right. So you go from nano stuff, you're moving into the solar cell arena. Was this the reason I asked the question about who kind of gave you your topic? Is in some other interviews I've done, I get the sense that the topic was given to the candidate because the professor kind of had these other ideas that he didn't have time to necessarily go and explore. Maybe you had that same opportunity with your second advisor. He already had kind of a path that he was going down. You were just his opportunity to expand on that.
That sounds very true to what I experienced.
Okay.
And these are conversations that happen over multiple meetings over periods of months. And maybe it would be helpful, the timeline, at least in the chemistry department at CSU, was, like you said, your first 2 years are heavily oriented towards coursework. You haven't picked a mentor yet. You haven't picked a research group yet, meaning an advisor and surrounding grad students and postdocs. And each one of those professors and their attendant groups have their own culture, their own vibe, and their own areas that they're interested in exploring.
Somebody likes Odell. Somebody likes Odell's Brewery, and other people like New Belgium.
Yeah. Okay. But also, some people are working on new drug targets for cancer. Some are working on solar cell research. Some are working on a new analysis method for detecting single molecules of unexploded ordnance, explosives. For finding mines. So there's a great diversity of research areas that you can choose from. And so during that first 2 years, when you're focused so much on coursework, you don't really have time to start doing research. And they don't want you to in the department. They really want to get your educational foundation laid before you start digging into the lab. So during that time frame, you do what's called a rotation with three different groups. So you pick three different professors to do a rotation through, and you spend time basically hanging out with their grad students, hanging out in their lab. You have a temporary office with the group. And so you get a feel for what day-to-day life is like for that research. And at that time, you kind of begin to see the menu, the a la carte menu of the different areas of research that they're exploring. And then you, and at that same time period, you talk to the advisor, you talk to the prospective professor that you want to work for, and you find out, well, what else do they have? What are they looking at in the future? What's coming up next? What do they not have someone already on? I mean, you might be the kind of person who wants to work in a field of research where there's three or four other people who are actively working with you and alongside of you, or you might be more of an independent person. So there's kind of this back and forth interview process that occurs during the rotations, group rotations, where both the professor and the student feel each other out to see what's a good fit, both in terms of the research areas that you're going to explore and in terms of who and how you're going to be working with other grad students in the group. Are you more independent or are you more of a team,
right,
on a team effort? And so there's a lot of variety there that you can choose from oftentimes.
Did you feel like you had a setback there? You know, you're in the middle of your PhD. Your guy is leaving. You got to find a new guy. Emotionally, how did that feel? And
it was traumatic. It was definitely traumatic. I remember feeling odd health wise. I didn't feel quite right, and I couldn't put my finger on it. And I went to the clinic at CSU, and they told me I had a heart arrhythmia, and so it was just this odd heartbeat, and it was I called it a premature
It was stress.
It was stress. Yes, and they said, can you cut down on your stress? And I kind of laughed. I'm like, I'm a grad student in chemistry. What do you think I can do about my stress? But no, it definitely affected me profoundly. I felt abandoned and the rug pulled out from under me. One of the distinctions, when you work for a professor who has a lot of funding from federal agencies like Department of Energy or NASA or the military, National Science Foundation. If you're a well-funded research professor, you can support your students so that they don't have to teach as a means to get their stipend to work through grad school. When I look at areas in the, like, say, liberal arts in grad school, they're basically paying their own way of their tuition, and they're not getting, a lot of times they're not getting stipends for living expenses. In the physical sciences, we would get stipends that we're basically, you were living at the poverty level, so a lot of us were taking out student loans to supplement that. But even though we were living at the poverty level, we were living high on the hog compared to, say, a liberal arts grad student, because these research dollars supported those stipends, and we did work in the lab as our means of getting that wage. And if you didn't have a professor who was fat with funding, you ended up teaching for the chemistry department. So you taught the labs and the undergraduate courses. You were maybe a TA with for a large lecture course, and you did the homework and the tests and the quizzes to assist the professor with that large mass of students, undergraduate students. And so it looked like I was most certainly going to have to teach for at least a couple of semesters when the one professor left and I started with a new professor. So yes, there was a big shock there. I ended up working it out where there was the professor who left and moved back to the University of Florida. He had a joint grant with a physics professor at CSU, and I was able to sort of continue working to the completion of that grant. I was basically doing wrap-up work to answer the final questions on some of the microstructures and nanomaterials work that we were doing jointly with the physics department. So much to the physics professor's chagrin, I talked them into supporting my stipend in that transition period. So I ended up not having to teach or TA, and that ended up helping my... I might have graduated in 7 or 7.5 years instead of just short of 6,
right,
had I ended up teaching, because teaching takes away from your time at the bench doing the actual research that will add to your chapters of your dissertation.
So let's talk about those last four chapters of the dissertation and putting those together.
Yeah, those others basically came about after that transition into the new group. And so, like I said, they were very interested in solar cell materials as well as optical materials. And that's where the lasers come in. Turns out lasers are a good light source for doing fundamental research for solar cell materials. I mean, the sun is a very bright light bulb. And it turns out that when you're doing the fundamental research, lasers are a handy tool. And so that was an unexpected twist in my research career, was to learn how to work safely and how to try the care and feeding of a laser, I'll call it, because they're finicky. Vacuum systems and laser systems both seem to break down if you look at them sideways.
How did it, when we were preparing for this, sitting down, I was setting up my equipment, you made a comment that at the end, it seems to me that even though you had this change in mentor, it sounds like the beginning was, that in-between period was rough, but at the end there was a pretty important bond and relationship that was formed.
That is true. That, I mean, my second advisor became a mentor, a friend. I don't know how differently my graduate career would have looked had I started with him, but it ended up being one of the best things that occurred to me in grad school, was having to make that transition, as traumatic as it was. Mike Elliott, who passed away in 2015, was an amazing mentor and became an amazing friend. And so, yeah, looking back, I can't begrudge that trauma of having that transition happen. During that transition period, he kind of let me flounder a little bit. While I was finishing out that grant that sort of kept me afloat from having to TA all the time and kept me into doing research at the bench, I was exploring some of these ideas that he had thrown at me, but he really hadn't given me a lot of detail. He had just told me, oh, I was thinking about looking into this. I was thinking about looking into molecules that would be good mediators in these kinds of solar cells. And I won't explain what that means. It's okay. But, you know, we were exploring. He had some radical ideas that he threw at me. And at the time, he was actually department chair. He was the chair of the chemistry department. So he didn't have as much time to spend with the students. He really, really made an effort to spend much time with us and to be there in the evenings sometimes when we were doing research to catch up with us. But it pulled him away a lot, and that left me floundering a bit. And I actually think that was good. It was wise on his part to read the kind of person I was. And it forced me to independently create new avenues of research. I took those lofty ideas that he had thrown at me, and I morphed them into something that was approachable from my perspective. So I started exploring some solar cell materials. I started exploring some laser-active, optically active materials. These are I ended up finding some materials that interacted with magnetic fields and light at the same time. So we were talking about like magneto-optical hard drives. If you think about, hard drives are magnetic memory, magnetically stored memory, and they've gotten really fancy at doing that on a very small scale. But we were looking at using laser pulses to do optical memory, and we ended up finding some pretty interesting molecules for that. But that used both magnets and lasers to define their bits, their right. Zeros and ones, if okay. You will. On the solar cell side, we ended up having a patent and several papers come out of the solar cell work. And there were several generations of grad students after me who picked up that work and ran with it as well. And they had papers. And I always kind of felt like, you know, there was a sort of relationship there with the younger students who came in after me to some of the work that I did. But that floundering period where I was kind of left to my own devices let me explore things in a creative way that, had an advisor been there guiding me every step of the way, we might not have ended up going in those directions, because some of the ideas were kind of outlandish or blasphemous, if you will.
Do you feel that maybe those early years with Dr. Elliott maybe helped form your ability to do the job as a forensic engineer now?
I think so. I think that there was a there was an element of the unknown that came through that floundering period, that transition period, those early years with Mike, where I really had to get creative in my thinking. I read a lot of fundamental research papers to try and inspire that. And in the forensic engineering world, there's so many different ways that things can go wrong, that any investigation can be completely different than anything you've ever investigated before. So absolutely, I think it influenced my ability to deal well with an unexplored area of knowledge. I oftentimes have to start from scratch to inform myself about, how does the chemistry of asphalt pavement work? I mean, we had a very successful project here where we solved the mystery of exploding asphalt mixing tanks. And to do that, I had to dig into the fundamental chemistry of asphalt and the additives that they put in the asphalt and how the whole process works from where it starts at the cracking plant in the petroleum industry and goes all the way to the road being laid down. And, you know, I think for a lot of chemists, being faced with a project where you go from having very little knowledge to having to become an expert very quickly in a very short amount of time, I think that's where that experience and that sort of floundering period really paid off. I find it very useful to approach a new investigation that may require me to educate myself a little bit in a new area that I wasn't familiar with before.
Let's talk about getting through these last four parts of your research. And normally a dissertation, a PhD project is focused on one single question to ask and to get those answers. Looks like you had four questions here, or five, that made up your dissertation at the end of the day. How, not that you've done it the other way, but to the best of your ability to look at what other people have done, was that more difficult, or in your mind, compartmentalizing those smaller projects made it easier?
I think it was because I consider myself to be a creative scientist, okay, in that seeing the path to more knowledge requires a creativity in the kind of tools and methods and experiments one designs to answer fundamental questions, to lead you from point A to point B. And then when you need to get to point C, how does one do that? That the creative side of science is where I find a lot of comfort, and it's my forte. When I was trying to find what my new field would be with this new professor, with this new research group, I had to explore more than one option. And it turned out that instead of just having one turn out strong and promising, three of them, minimally three of them, turned out very promising. And so I explored them. And so those turned into three very different chapters. There was always going to be a separation between the work that I did with my first advisor and then when I jumped ship and joined the second group. There was always going to be a break between those two groups and the different areas of research. But you're right. Most students would have just said, all right, I'm going to focus on solar cells. That seems to be, of all the different areas that our group is exploring, that's the one I'm most interested in and the one that I think I've got some good ideas to try out. All right. It turned out that, you know, the solar cells were taking off, the optical magnetic sensors were taking off, and then another area of solar cells also took off. So, and these were just sort of attempts in the dark to try something outlandish during that floundering period of what am I going to do next? And because we found that there was meat on all three bones. And so I don't know. I think some grad students get lucky. I mean, I don't want to say I'm just good. I mean, it's better to be lucky than good. It's even better to be lucky and good.
Right.
But, you know, and not to be so egotistical about it. But, you know, I was fortunate that I stumbled into three research areas that just seemed to work. And some of those are still ongoing, even though, you know, my advisor's group is no longer around. There's basically branches that, you know, filtered into other professors' research there in the chemistry department. And so there's still an evidence of some of that line of work to this day.
Of the four things that make up your dissertation, your PhD research, what's the stuff that maybe somebody listening to this is going to be affected by the most? Or has it happened yet, or is it close? I'm guessing you're an inquisitive guy. You're paying attention to what's going on out there. You know what people are building off of your work here.
I think that there is, some of it is yet to come out. Some of it, there are, right now in the cutting edge world of personal electronics, okay, everyone is striving for flexible. All right, we've got curved OLED TVs now. Back when I was in grad school, I had to always explain what OLED
right.
stood for, that it's an organic light-emitting diode. Now, almost everyone, if they don't know what it stands for, they at least know it's cool, that I want an OLED TV or I want an OLED display on my cell phone. You know, the cell phone technology has advanced so fast. I mean, all of us are replacing our phones at a breakneck pace. It's almost ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm holding on to my 5 until October when, you know, the 8s are coming.
Right, right. And or some people will maybe buy the 7s because the price will finally come
right,
down.
Yeah.
You know, but this breakneck pace of personal electronics development, the cell phone industry has really, really pushed that to an extreme level, at like how fast the new generations of devices come out. Well, the people who are behind this fundamental research and the fundamental engineering behind all of these high-tech devices that have become so ubiquitous in our lives, they're looking for the future that they're looking at involves flexible, lightweight, thinner. I mean, these crazy ideas where you could literally have a laser pointer that you can pull a display out of and it
right.
will unroll like a projector screen, like you're pulling down a projector screen from the ceiling. You know, you look at Popular Mechanics, you look at Popular Science magazine, you look at the things that they're showing, they involve flexible electronics. And so some of the fundamental materials development work that I did for solar cells is also applicable for displays, but it's also applicable to portable devices, portable electronic devices. You know, as we all know, when we're sitting in an airport, we need to plug in and charge our amazing smartphones,
right?
What I call the tricorders of reality. But, you know, they're power-hungry devices. So I think that my legacy in terms of real world is just having contributed to that pie-in-the-sky vision of light, flexible electronic displays and power generations. I mean, I've actually got a portable solar cell panel that I take with me when I go hunting in Alaska or fishing in Alaska
right.
when I'm in the backwoods. While I didn't contribute to the research of the materials that are in that actual device, I was in that world. I was dabbling in that world, and we were pushing the technology forward. So, you know, I still hope that maybe one day there'll be a license for one of my patents for one of these materials. But, you know, even if that doesn't happen, that's okay, because I still feel like I was in the mix. I was in pushing the edge of research and development of materials. We were trying outlandish ideas at times and succeeding. Now, it isn't in my graduate work, but more in my the R&D that I did in my early career. We were actually working on soft neural electrodes. Okay, I said the words electronic polymer when we started this interview. Well, continuing on that, I picked that line of research up later in my career, and we were actually working with a group at the University of Pittsburgh on neural implanting electrodes, where we were, you know, wires aren't very comfortable if you stick them through your skin.
Right.
Patients who have to do rehabilitative muscular neuromuscular work have learned this. Putting electrodes in your skin is painful. Well, sticking a metal wire in your brain also has its problems. And so we were taking our electronic polymers and we were making really squishy materials that could still conduct electricity. And it turns out that when you tuck those into the brain doesn't have as big a problem as when you stick a wire in it. So some of that work is ongoing, and I'm seeing blurbs of work like that in Popular Science magazine and Scientific American. So when you see work like that coming out in headlines in more popular press, that's very fulfilling for me.
So it begs the question then, why did you decide then to go the forensic route? What brought about that change?
I think the fundamental motivator behind it was I was nearly 12 years in fundamental R&D, where as a principal investigator, that's what the leaders of research groups call themselves. We were responsible for going after and maintaining the funding for that R&D development, and that world is very competitive. And myself and several other principal investigators at the company I worked for were very good at getting that funding for over a decade. But competition picked up. What was it called when the politicians decided to defund all of the scientific organizations and Department of Energy? It was sequester? Was that what it was? Okay, so when that occurred, basically a lot of budgets got frozen at places like Department of Energy, DARPA, National Institutes of Health, NSF. And these were our bread and butter for funding our work and keeping, I had a team of chemists and engineers who worked for me on my projects, and I kept them employed and, kept them paying their bills, and we did lots of good work along the way. But that was a hard life to live in terms of living and dying by whether a grant is accepted or not. And it just got so competitive and the funding got so small that I had an opportunity to jump ship to... I did a little stint with a startup company, with a materials startup company, and that didn't really fit for me. It was a security issue. It was a sort of a long-term viability and security issue where the writing was on the wall for both the grant writing and the startup company that I wasn't comfortable. I wanted a little bit more of a stable ground underneath me. And so I began my job search as I realized that maybe R&D, maybe I needed to make a change, like you said. Maybe that was sort of a drastic change to make. And it happened through the world of online resumes and job postings, quite honestly. Forensic engineering was not necessarily on my radar when I was doing my job searches. But as the months dragged on being unemployed, that job search and the areas I was interested in would, loosen up a bit. And as soon as I scratched the surface on when you take the two words forensic and engineering, or forensic and science. Now, forensics and science, I mean, we all think of CSI and, right, and the law enforcement side of things. So I wasn't aware that there was this whole other world out there. And it was literally the job posting that AEI had put out for a material scientist and a metallurgist. And those weren't, I called myself an analytical chemist, a materials chemist, or a materials scientist. I didn't necessarily think of myself as a metallographer at the time, but once I scratched the surface of what is forensic engineering, what is metallurgy, what is metallography, what is fractography, and these were all things that I had been doing throughout my career and didn't know what the terms were. So it was really a very related field to what I had been doing. The fundamental tools were the same, the microscopes, the analytical instruments, the other chemical analyses techniques. These were all the same, but instead of starting from an idea on a chalkboard and developing material suited for a new device or toy or whatever. We were taking something broken and trying to reconstruct how it had gotten there. But the tools were the same. And the creative thinking of how you get from point A to point B to point C in learning, you know, in enhancing your knowledge and raising the information you have available to you, informing what could have occurred, what was possible, what was probable. Those same tools are the same in the forensic engineering world as they are in the R&D world for a material scientist. So it's been an amazing fit. And I'm almost 2 years in at this stage. And at the end of this month will be 2 years. And it's been an exciting and an excellent fit.
But rather than asking for grants, now you're worried about your billable hours.
True. True. I mean, yeah, in any career, there's always a... there's always the heartburn areas of how one makes money and how one stays profitable and viable,
right,
and keeping the treadmill going. I don't think that would be different in any field for a scientist. You know.
What would 18-year-old Sean think of where you're at now?
I honestly think you would be amazed that... Without a strategic plan mapped out from the age of 18 or from the age of 20 on, that you could end up in a career like I'm in. It feels like I got here by accident in some ways, because I had a false start with environmental engineering. I had a false start with the University of Florida and my education. I had a little bit of a false start in grad school, picking a professor that ended up moving and having to switch career, switch graduate research areas and advisors. But I've ended up in a very cool place and in a very good career and a very solid career, feeling like I'm well suited to it as well. I mean, that's not so, that's something that I'll find myself talking at parties with friends and realizing that I'm talking excitedly about some of the work I do, and sort of that level of excitement and satisfaction is not something that everyone can say they have. And so I have to remind myself at times that there were some random circumstances that led me to get here. It didn't take a complete roadmap or a complete foresight in how to get here, but it worked out. So I think 18-year-old Sean would be surprised to have such a diverse and a technical job, but yet allows for creativity. And that is intellectually satisfying, intellectually fulfilling. So I think the 18-year-old Sean would be pleasantly surprised that it worked out despite having a completely different idea of where he was headed at the time.
Thanks for sharing your journey and piling it high and deep. Appreciate your time. Thanks.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Ted.
Well, thanks again to Sean Sapp. Really appreciate your time. What a great story. Just really am enjoying doing these podcasts, and I hope you're enjoying them too. Also want to thank Dennis Shelp. He's one of the principals at Advanced Engineering Investigations over there in Littleton, Colorado. Dennis, thanks a lot for helping me out. I've known Dennis for a long time, and that's actually not the first time I met Sean. We didn't talk about it. We both share a love of music. Sean and I attended a fabulous Iron Maiden show last April here in the Denver area. The music that you hear in the background, that is the Canadian trio Rush, my favorite band of all time. The tune is Chemistry off of Signals. Just kind of seemed like the right thing to have for our music today. Well, I'm not sure what's coming up next on the show. Stay tuned. I've got quite a few invites out in the world. Until then, if you know of any PhDs you think I should be talking to, or if you yourself are a PhD and want to share your story, shoot me a note via the interwebs. You can direct message me on Twitter or send me a note via my blog at themountaingeek.net. Also, be sure to review the podcast if you like what you're hearing. You can give us a review over on iTunes. By the way, we're now on Stitcher, so if you've caught the show there, please let me know. Again, the Twitter handle is at PhD Podcast. Facebook, Piled High and Deep, the podcast. You can send me a note that way as well. Thanks for your time. And as always, keep shoveling.